to Geoffrey and to call for the kind invitation to speak, particularly if this is your first meeting of this season. So the Chief Medical Officer is also an obstetrician, and I'm the only Chief Medical Officer ever to fill some patients. I'm also the first female Chief Medical Officer in Scotland. So I have three children, and my children used to understand what I did for a living, so I went to work to help the ladies who were having their babies. But when I got this new job, my son and I were walking into school together. He was holding my hand and he said, "Mummy, this new job of yours, it's all about keeping people healthy, isn't it?" I said, "This is George, it is. Not going to dance, do you?" I said, "No, George, I'm not. I'm not so unlikely to dance one." Don't say that publicly. So, one of the roles of the Chief Medical Officer is to write an annual report every year. And that annual report is a snapshot of the health of the nation. So, a lot of data, a lot of statistics, and of course, in Scotland, what essentially comes up as is too much alcohol, too much sugar, too much tobacco, and not enough running around. So I did that with all of the data, which is very helpfully presented in the second half of my report. But what I decided to do with the first half of the report is something a little different. So I wrote an open letter to the medical profession in Scotland and asked them to practice medicine differently. Because when I was going out and about around the country, I was hearing from my medical colleagues that they were not feeling that the medical profession was being listened to, that they were feeling that their status had been eroded, they were feeling all this pressure of time, pressure of volume of work. And they also felt that they were sometimes being pushed into practicing medicine that wasn't the medicine that had taken them to medical school. So I wrote to them and asked them six questions, and I'll talk to you about those in more detail in a moment. But I have then asked for feedback, because I didn't know whether what I was thinking about medicine would resound at all with other people. But in fact, it has been widely recognised and welcomed by not only by doctors, but by nurses, by pharmacists, by physiotherapists, by paramedics, and by people not only in Scotland, but all over the world. So the social media that is Twitter, which you may or may not think is a good thing, I like Twitter because I can get the 140 character snapshot of the news before I get out of bed in the morning, and then I have myself psyched up for what the radio is going to be asking me about later that day. So Twitter has shared my realistic medicine report 5 million times all over the world. Mm-hmm. And I haven't had a single negative comment. So what I asked the medical profession was that could we practice realistic medicine? So should we be changing the way that we're practicing medicine? Change it to shared decision making? And to build a more personalised approach to care? So I'm going to tell you two stories. The first story is about a man in Ayrshire. When you're the Chief Medical Officer, you get invited to visit all sorts of parts of Scotland. And when you visit, lots of people are brought forward to speak to you. So I went to Ayrshire, and this man came forward to be introduced to me. And they told me that he was speaking to me because he had recently had a knee replacement. And I said, "Hello, how's the new knee? Are you pleased with your new knee?" "Not really." I said, "Is it not working? Are you in pain?" "Well, you see, doctor, I didn't really want a new knee." "What was it you wanted?" "I wanted a grab rail." "So you wanted a grab rail?" "Yes, because I like to stand on my doorstep and speak to my neighbour. And my knees were sore, and so a grab rail would help me do that." Now, I still haven't got a grab rail, but what they've given me is a knee replacement. And I still can't stand on my doorstep. So I wonder, and I'm sure the clinicians who saw that man, that the knee, no doubt, had osteoarthritis, no doubt it was bad enough to have the necessity of a knee replacement, but actually that wasn't what that man asked for, nor did that man get what he was actually prioritising. I'll tell you another story. This is about the man in Lanarkshire. Now, this man has an unusual hobby, as you can tell. He also has pigeon fancier's lung, perhaps unsurprisingly. So this has meant that over the years he is regularly admitted to hospital. His lungs deteriorate year on year, as you might expect them to. He has onset of breathlessness, he gets a little bit worse, he comes in and out of hospital. So a phone call came, a friend of mine was on call, Jerry Trishmer, care of the elderly physician in Lanarkshire. The call came in that this man was once again breathless and couldn't be admitted. And Graham had started a new hospital at home in Lanarkshire, where people are unable to stay at home to be looked after. There are virtual wardrobes for Skype and nursing staff coming to give them medication every day. And Graham said, maybe this man would be suitable for the hospital at home. So he decided to go out and visit the man. Nobody had ever been in this man's house. Graham went in, interviewed him. Yes, indeed, he was very breathless. Probably he needed to be admitted to hospital. And Graham started the conversation with him about the pigeons. You can tell where this conversation would be going. Well, you do realise that your lungs are getting worse because of the pigeons. You do realise that if you got rid of the pigeons, you would stop deteriorating, you wouldn't be admitted to hospital, you might live longer. And you could see the man's daughter in the corner of the room, sort of beckoning him. So he stopped the conversation about giving up the pigeons, and the daughter said, I think, Doctor, you might like to see my father's back room. So these pictures aren't very clear because this is a tiny little room. And you'll see that those trophies, those pictures are portraits of his pigeons. He has a portrait of every winning pigeon. He then believes actually that they stopped winning. He is actually, at one time, was the UK's best pigeon whisperer. And those sheds that you can see in the bottom corner contain 200 to 300 pigeons. And his prize racing pigeon was sold for 30,000. So what did the daughter say to Graham? Doctor, he's not giving up his pigeons. Will you stop asking him to do that? He would rather die than give up his pigeons. He goes to the hospital every 6 months, they give him the lecture about the pigeons, he comes home, goes back into the shed, he stays with them, he talks to them, he feeds them, he loves them for 2 or 3 hours every day. He's not been one of the pigeons. So I wonder, when I ask people, what is it that is the priority? We can give medicine to this man, and in fact, Graham kept him at home. He hooked up the IV antibiotics to the standard lamp in the sitting room. He gave him an injection of IV hydrocortisone and left him at home to be looked after there. But do we really talk to people about what their priorities are? Do we really enable people to have that personalised care? And then to let Alistair tell his own story. So Caroline is a renal physician in Edinburgh, and Alistair agrees to tell us his story.
Well, I would say my current medical condition has not improved in the last 3 months. And at that point, every after the fear, I was very unwell indeed. At the moment, I'm not surprised how much I've improved after the treatment I had in the renal department. And it was all done, in my opinion, through close consultation with other specialists. The GI people, for example, who came to a very good team decision between me and yourself, and I was much delighted in my current situation because I thought I was going to fall off the edge at one point.
What were those decisions?
We discussed it with the team, and they said, well, the certain thing we can use it, right? Prolong your life to a considerable extent. That's very happy to have a shorter term with quality of life rather than just dragging on in the same old drugs and everything else. So, decided to come off his work in the month of 18 years. just took the offer and I was it. And he was also on amiodarone, which a pharmacist then told me that my own pain in the same way poison. So I've come off amiodarone and then I went, and I was given another one to control the bumps in my stomach. And since then I've gone through day by day.
If you're deteriorating to the point that diabetes might be considered in another patient with that level of compulsion, what do you understand about diabetes? And what's the message to the person who
knows? Well, I've been in hospital with lots of people that didn't have any diabetes, so we made a decision, or somebody made a decision, that that's the right thing for them. And you don't just ask you to do what you want to know, or just ask me, and you don't know, I don't know how to do it.
Why not?
I don't want to do every second day in a year. I've got so many things wrong, and Dallas was just part of the whole thing, you know.
We sometimes talk about shared decision-making. Is that something that you recognize that's happened with your care?
The condition I'm in now, I thought it was due to making a shared decision between my consultant and doctor, and that hasn't always worked to me.
Have you ever felt under pressure not to have a particular treatment?
No.
I think our doctors can sometimes find it very hard to be very honest and explicit to patients, particularly when it's about new back news. How do you feel about that?
It doesn't come easy, but I'm sure it's part of the job, and I don't think it should be done coldly either. You can't just suddenly tell them, don't buy a season ticket or something else in the next benefits of both the clinician and the patient, and some sort of report established. Clinicians, doctors have greatly said, man, there are some other people who still have to learn it. And I'm, as an outsider, I don't know how you do it.
So, algebra is one of Caroline's conservative dialysis clinic patients. The conservative hemodialysis clinic is so conservative that in fact you don't get hemodialysis at all when you attend that clinic. So where did all of this come from? Where did this thinking come from? I think on reflection it's done several things. I think as an obstetrician we have in maternity services always had our women, as most of them are not ill. Patients in the same sense as people were using the NHS for other reasons. And we've always had quite a holistic approach to our pregnant women and their partners, their families, their other children. And of course we also give women choice in where they're going to have their babies and in what way they're going to have their babies. So I think perhaps my background is not sufficient for that. The other thing that happened was that I read a lot of research about doctors and the choices that doctors make at the end of life. So at the end of life, 88% of doctors would not have hemodialysis. 95% of doctors would not agree to have CPR to be resuscitated in the event of a cardiac arrest. And 67% of doctors would not be admitted to intensive care at the end of their lives. And that made me think, well, what is it that I know that would make me act differently to what people do for the patient? Well, of course, in fact, the patients get all of these things offered to them. But in fact, that's not what the doctors will do for themselves or their own family. A recent study in the New England Journal of Medicine, and this is American, but they took a group of patients and a group of their physicians, and they spoke to the physicians about what they thought was important for their patients. And the physicians all said, well, they want to live longer. So what I'm going to do is do whatever I can do, intervene whatever way I can, give them drugs and medication to make sure that they live longer because that's what they want. And then they spoke to the patient. And not a single patient prioritize living longer. The patient goal said two things. One, I want to be symptom free, and secondly, I want to spend time with my family. So what is it about the disconnect between what the medical profession and other healthcare professionals are doing that actually isn't necessarily what the people we're looking after are asking us for? And the third thing then that happened was the Montgomery ruling, which is a legal ruling following the delivery of a baby who had severe disabilities in Lanarkshire some 16 years ago. That court case has just come through about 2 years ago. That lady had a big baby, she had diabetes, and during delivery the baby got stuck. There was a degree of shoulder dystocia, and the baby ended up with the difficulties, lifelong disability, very significant. So when this case came to court, what happened was that the case was presented about the risk of a cesarean section electively for that lady versus her having a normal delivery. And she said that if she had been counseled about the risks of anything happening as did happen with her son, she would of course have opted for an elective cesarean section. Because any tiny risk, no matter how small, was not going to be worth taking for the outcome that she ended up with. And the court ruled in her favour. So previously in the UK, what we had was that practice had to be what any reasonable doctor felt were the risks that needed to be explained. And any reasonable doctor practicing in a way that was similar to the case going to court. But we now have the Montgomery ruling. And what the Montgomery ruling would say to us is, it's what the patient thinks are the risks that we need to be consenting for. Not the doctor, but when the patient has the procedure explained to them, where would it be that they would face the risk? So we have a UK legal precedent which actually can now be applied retrospectively to cases that are coming through the court. So I suppose what I think is that this puts the patient at the centre of what we're doing. I have three children, so I have to tell three children related to schools. So this means all of mine, it takes me all over the place. I've been to Hampden on the football pitch to have my photo taken. I've been to Barcelona, as Colin said. So we were driving to school one day, and my middle daughter Anna said, "Mummy, what weird things are you doing today?" Well, I'm going to a conference and to think about outpatient time. There are far too many outpatient appointments, far too many outpatients coming to be seen, and we need to do something about it. By the way, there are 4.7 million outpatient appointments in Scotland every year. There are only 5.2 million people, and it's not. So I said, this outpatient issue is a big issue, we need to do something about it. And she said, "Mummy, what's an outpatient?" It's a patient that is in the hospital. She said, "Yes." I said, well, they come to the hospital or to the clinic and we see them and then they go in again. And she said, "Well, where do they go? Home, or back to work, or back to school, or back to whatever they were doing." And she said, "It's another person." So I wonder whether the people formerly known as patients get embroiled in our healthcare system, and we sometimes maybe forget, like our Asian family gentlemen, that they actually have other lives and have other things to do, and that our bit of their life is not necessarily the most important or as important to them as we think it might be. So, in answering my question, I came also to talking about reducing harm and waste. And what I talk about is that waste is traditionally understood as a wasteful system. People think about waste as being things that are thrown away. But I would actually talk about waste as being when something is done that doesn't add value. That is in fact wasteful. If it isn't adding value to the person that we're treating, then that is a waste of resource, a waste of medicine, a waste of money. And I talk also about unnecessary variation in practice.
and on necessary variation in outcome. So if I tell you that I see a lot of data, I go to a lot of conferences and I sit through a lot of audits. So in my own practice of obstetrics and gynecology, if I told you that the hysterectomy rates across the UK varies by a factor of 5-fold, and the induction of labour rate in Scotland is 32% in one hospital and 18% in another hospital. And I'm not prepared to blame the mothers, the babies, or the wounds for those differences in practice. And I look then in other specialties. So if we take hip fracture, the commonest fracture in numbers, very debilitating. We know that the outcome is better if you have your hip fracture repaired with a hip replacement within 36 hours. When we look at what the total time that people are in hospital after a hip fracture, that varies across Scotland from a median of 13 days in one unit to a median of 23 days in another unit. And in one unit in Scotland, 63% of people get back home after their hip fracture. And in another unit in Scotland, 95% of people get back home after their hip fracture. And I'm not prepared to blame the hips or the elderly people for those very issues either. When I look at urology, the rate of cystoscopy, so minor bladder symptoms need a bit of a look in the bladder, the rate of cystoscopy varies across Scotland by a factor of 4-fold. Again, not the bladder's fault. So everywhere I go, I look at these data and I ask questions. I don't know what the right rate of hysterectomy is. The right rate of induction of labour is. But I don't talk to the orthopaedic surgeons about how long people should stay in hospital. So I ask the questions, and in fact people are often very surprised by these differences in data, these differences in how the best units are performing in a small country compared to others. So I think we need to reduce this unwarranted variation in practice, because what it leads to is unwarranted differences in outcome. People do less well if their hip is not repaired in the practice of surgery. So I talk also about managing risks. Managing risks, of course, in our Scottish World Median Scottish Patient Safety Programme has made huge differences to hospital mortality rates, to our infection rates in hospitals, big falls in the mass, which are major, major issues. And Colin kindly talked about the work that I've done in reducing stillbirth in Scotland. Our stillbirth rates have been static for 20 years in Scotland. Our stillbirth rate has fallen by 18% in the last 4 years since we looked at stillbirths, the causes of stillbirths, and decided not to accept that stillbirths just happened because they just happened, and actually did something about it. And so there were 100 families who took a baby home last year, 100 more families who took a baby home last year than had taken a baby home the year before, because we've managed to prevent those 100 stillbirths. So that's very important. But managing risk, of course, is very sophisticated. And the senior decision maker who takes the riskiest decisions is often the medical professional. Other professionals also do, but the doctor is often the one who is taking those difficult decisions. But do we realise that when people are under stress, when they're overworked, when the volume of work is greater, then it is that decision making about risk that disappears first? So people become very risk averse when they are stressed. So I wonder whether we actually support our health service colleagues, our nurses, doctors, physios, pharmacists, paramedics, because actually what they will become is risk averse. They'll make poorer decisions, and that will affect outcomes. Do we manage this better by supporting our staff? So I also talk about becoming improvers and innovators. So I think that people think that innovators need to be inventing a machine or a cure for something. But in fact, what I have seen is innovation everywhere I've been to. So I've been to some of the wards where the most junior doctors were telling me about their quality improvement and practices.
So if you've been junior doctors, one of their tasks, and if you have been junior doctors, one of their tasks is of course to take the blood. There are phlebotomists to help, but the doctor always ends up with the most difficult cases to get the blood from. So what the junior doctors realised was that there are always a lot of blood tests left over at the end of the day that haven't been taken. What they also realised was that this was actually delaying discharge for some of these people because the result was being expected by the consultant, the result wasn't ready, and in fact the blood hadn't actually left the patient's arm. So what they did was they filmed on their iPhones, they filmed all of the steps that it is from someone asking for a blood test to that blood test getting the result in the patient's nose. And they realised that during that process there were 8 redundant steps, either repeated or not needed at all. So they chopped out the 8 redundant steps, they spoke to their phlebotomy colleagues, got a system, much more efficient, and they actually reduced the length of stay on that hospital ward. The most junior, cost nothing, and yet those people were the right people to be changing their own system, because they, as the junior doctors, are the ones that knew where the change could be made. But I also talked then about bigger improvement, bigger innovation. And what I asked was whether, in fact, we are actually implementing the practice in medicine that we already know works well. So you'll be familiar, perhaps, with the need, the guidance to give people aspirin if they've had a cardiovascular event. A stroke or a heart attack, you get aspirin, and that will prevent, to some extent, a second event. And most people are eligible to have aspirin. In Scotland, how many people who are eligible for aspirin get aspirin, I wonder? Stroke, might get another one. Let's give you something that costs £1.50 to prevent another stroke. Pretty simple. Well, only 57% of people who are eligible for aspirin actually get it. So, what do we do about that problem? Well, what we did was, we thought, I know what, let's do a lot of work in the lab and come up with another drug that's much more effective. It's called clopidogrel, and it is more effective. But it would need to be 90% more effective to have the same effect as giving the other 43% of people aspirin who are actually eligible for aspirin. The drug costs 10 times as much, and I'm afraid it's only 10% more effective than aspirin. Well, I talk in my report about translating what we know in research into actual practice on the ground. And I talk about the importance of research being actually relevant to the NHS, and the importance of research into treatments or medication that's actually going to be used by the NHS. Perhaps maybe moving away from research for research's sake. And actually moving into something where public money is being spent to improve our outcomes. So maybe we need some research into why everybody doesn't get aspirin. Not inventing another drug that's a bigger, better aspirin. So I talk about that, and I talk to academic audiences about that. They don't necessarily feel that I'm necessarily the most popular question in the room when I challenge them like that, but I think it's important to ask the question. This, after all, is public money. So, you'll see on my slide that the infographic has been shared all over the world, and what people have then said is we're not sure that we really like this realistic medicine, it's a bit medical. And I said, well, I'm a doctor, and I'm the chief medical officer, and I wrote to the doctor, so that was where this came from. But actually, a lot of different groups would like to have their own version of realistic medicine. The pharmacists would like to be called realistic medicine. And then it's been suggested that it should be realistic healthcare, or in fact, perhaps realistic health and social care. And I have no problem with that, because I think what this has become is a way of talking about facts in medicine. And whether that's medicine or healthcare or health and social care, I don't mind. So
So this is the Twitter stuff in case you believe me, and that's the slide you're going to have to see. Some of you may or may not know Sir Muir Gray. He is really one of the founding fathers of public health. He invented screening, as we know it, and his comment was, Catherine Coleman was understated in my praise. It's one of the best documents I have read in 44 years. And he's read a lot of government documents. So, where do we go? What do we do? Where do we go next with this? So, these are some of the comments that I thought the Philosophical Society would like to be talking about. And I was very pleased actually to be coming back to Rotter Row. I haven't been in Rotter Row since I was a medical student in Glasgow and learned by reception in the maternity unit, so fair enough. So is this just emotion? I told you some nice anecdotal stories, and then Catherine goes with some jolly lively stories about my own children. So perhaps this is just emotional. Someone has said it's enlightening. Is this a new way of thinking? And our medical schools around the country have said that they will put realistic medicine on their syllabus for women. It seems to have a global application. My Barcelona conference has now got spread to Quebec City and an invite to Salzburg in Austria in December. Does it maybe bring back the art of medicine? A little bit more art. Look at that. And I wonder, does it play to the very well-known Scottish intellectual and philosophical wisdom? And maybe that's why it's been well received at the time. What I have done, though, is really try to make sure that it is joining up with the vision of the Scottish Government. You may or may not have had time to read the National Clinical Strategy for Scotland. You'll find within it a chapter on realistic medicine. And what I'm saying to my ministerial colleagues, my government policy colleagues, is that I think that some of these difficult decisions that have to be made about healthcare can perhaps be made better if we're practicing the various aspects of realistic medicine and bringing the patients or the people along with us on that journey. And so far, I haven't had any dissent. So I would propose to you that perhaps this is a new Hippocratic philosophy. This puts my doctoral colleagues back in their positions of leadership. It is absolutely about the multidisciplinary team. Absolutely must be. I couldn't do my job as an obstetrician without the midwives, couldn't do my job as an obstetrician without the healthcare workers, nor the theatre assistant, nor the person who cleans the theatre after the cesarean section. So I am absolutely sold on the multidisciplinary team. But the multidisciplinary team needs leadership. And the leadership often falls in the hands of the doctors or the most senior member of the team. So I wonder if we can also be creative. Certainly it's about empathy, always has been. But perhaps the medic, the doctors, the healthcare professional, whoever that may be, is more of a facilitator, more of a collaborator. And they definitely need to be a communicator. They study in the 1970s, they interview medical students when they started. They start medical school very, very, very passion focused. And they leave it disease focused. But it isn't diseases they're looking after, is it? So it's perhaps that person at the centre of the care that we should be talking to. So I'm going to a close now. This was a cartoon that somebody sent to me. You may be familiar with the Scottish Intercollegiate Guideline Network, the Spanning Guidelines. And Boyd Peters, who's a medical director in NHS Highlands, is a psychiatrist. He's written a drawing of my business manager, Mark, standing at my door, some wise guy, doctor on the phone, asking for the Spanning Guidelines for realistic medicine. Which has made me think. And once I suspect I can track down John Kinsella, who's the chair of the Spanning the committee, I perhaps will put it to him that maybe we do need a guideline for realistic medicine. So I hope it's meant something to this audience. I'm very grateful, as I say, for the invitation. And I know we've got plenty of time for questions and answers. I leave you with my contact details. So email me, tweet, look at the blog. I hope that realistic medicine really takes off and goes somewhere. but it won't do it without support and without feedback and comments. So thank you very much.